Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we take complex source material, you know, the technical reports, the research papers, the dissertation chapters, and we distill them down into the core knowledge you need to be instantly informed. Today, we are deep diving into the fascinating microscopic world of high-performance materials. We're talking nickel-based superalloys. And our mission, which comes straight from the sources, is to really understand the phase separation mechanisms that govern their ultimate strength. The stakes here are just. They're enormous. These alloys are not just strong. They're absolutely crucial components in systems where failure is, well, it's not an option. Think jet engines, gas turbines, advanced power plants. I mean, they're operating at service temperatures up to 800 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm.
Their ability to survive that heat, all that stress, it relies entirely on maintaining a perfectly stable internal microstructure.
And that internal stability, it's all achieved through a two-phase structure. It's known as gamma-gamma prime, or YY. You can think of the gamma phase, the Y, as the main bulk. It's the face-centered cubic matrix. This is mostly nickel, but it's loaded up with a solid solution of other elements like chromium, molybdenum, tungsten.
So that's the foundation.
Exactly. And suspended within that gamma matrix is the gamma prime phase, the Y. This is the reinforcing component. It's a second phase precipitate based on the compound niol, which has this highly ordered structure called L1 Uros. And that ordered, rigid framework of Y particles is what gives the superalloy its incredible resistance to creeping and softening at high temperatures.
So these microscopic Y particles are the key. They're everything to the alloy's performance. The entire source material we're looking at is really dedicated to answering one fundamental question. How exactly do those YY distributions form? Because if we understand the mechanism, we can control the material.
Exactly right. Commercial superalloys, you know, they can contain maybe a dozen different elements, which makes them incredibly complex to study directly. That's why this research focuses on model alloys, much simpler versions, to try and isolate the phase transition mechanisms. But before we even get to the experimental evidence, we have to grasp the two dominant competing theories for how materials transition from one structure into two.
Okay, let's unpack those, starting with, I guess, the conventional route that most of us are probably familiar with.
Right. The first and oldest route is nucleation and growth. This is the standard phase change process. Think like boiling water or crystal formation. It's non-isostructural, meaning the final crystal structure is different from the original, and it requires overcoming a pretty substantial energy barrier to create a stable reaction intermediate, or what we call a nucleus.
A nucleus, yeah.
The classic thermodynamic description going all the way back to Gibbs says that the compositional change is large in degree and small in extent.
What does that mean exactly?
Okay. Think of it this way. When the first nucleus forms, it's tiny, right? Small in extent. But its composition is already drastically different from the matrix all around it, large in degree. It then just grows larger over time, consuming the matrix.
That makes perfect sense. A new thing appears, and then it gets bigger. But the second theory, the one the research is really trying to prove, is, well, it's far more counterintuitive, continuous phase change.
Also known as bonodal decomposition. And this one, yeah, it's the wild card. It happens when the initial phase is thermodynamically unstable, even against tiny, tiny compositional fluctuations. It's an isostructural change. The crystal lattice stays the same, but the atoms start shuffling almost simultaneously.
Everywhere.
Everywhere, throughout the entire volume. Here, the compositional change is described as small in degree, but large in extent.
The exact opposite.
The exact opposite. No nucleus is needed. The matrix composition gradually shifts everywhere at once, forming these waves of rich and lean areas. It's a bit like watching a paint mixture that was never truly stable suddenly and gradually separate into swirls of different colors throughout the can all at the same time.
That's a great analogy. It separates all at once, everywhere, but just slightly. And the key to proving this mechanism is kinetic, which brings us to the famous work of J.W. Kahn, who introduced the idea of uphill diffusion.
Correct. Kahn's theory is what separates spinodal decomposition from everything else. In normal, you know, conventional diffusion, atoms move from high concentration to low concentration. They spread out. That's downhill.
But Kahn's theory requires atoms to move uphill, meaning they move against the concentration gradient. They cluster together in areas that are already rich in those atoms, which just makes the separation worse. It sounds like it violates the laws of physics or something. What drives atoms to do that?
It's the free energy landscape. In the spinodal region, the system is so inherently unstable that any tiny fluctuation that increases the local concentration actually lowers the total free energy of the system.
I see. So the instability itself is the driving force.
It is. And mathematically, Kahn proved that this means the interdiffusivity, the metric for how elements move relative to each other, must have a negative value. That negative sign is the definitive proof of spinodal decomposition.
So the goal for the researchers becomes finding a way to measure a negative number for diffusion, which that sounds like a massive challenge at the atomic scale.
Yeah.
Plus, the sources mentioned that if elastic strain is present, which it always is in these interfaces, we can actually see it.
Yes. The strain energy, which is caused by the slight mismatch between the Y and Y lattices, actually depresses the coherent stability boundary. It promotes the spinodal process. And when that periodic compositional variation, that sine wave of composition Kahn predicted exists under strain, it results in a very characteristic visual signature, a fine periodic striated structure under the electron microscope.
A striated look.
Yeah, reflecting tiny periodic variations in the lattice parameter. That look is the fingerprint of continuous change.
Okay, we have a theory. Uphill diffusion, composition waves, and negative diffusivity. Now, the biggest hurdle, how do you observe these atomic scale changes and test Kahn's really sophisticated kinetic diffusion equations? You need tools that can literally see and identify individual atoms.
And that tool is atom probe field ion microscopy, or APFM. It's just phenomenal. Imagine taking a specimen and machining it into a needle tip only about 20 nanometers across. You apply an extremely high positive potential, maybe 5 to 25 kilovolts, to this tiny tip.
20 nanometers, that's incredibly small.
It is. And you use a laser pulse or a voltage pulse to literally strip off the surface atoms one by one as positive ions. As those ions fly toward the detector, the time it takes for them to travel their time of flight allows us to measure their mass to charge ratio with extreme precision.
So you know what element it is.
And you know exactly where it was on the tip's surface.
So we're dissecting the material atom by atom. This gives us two crucial outputs, quantitative atom probe, or QAP, which is a profile of composition versus distance.
Our atomic data chain.
And imaging atom probe, IAP, which gives us a 2D map of where the different elements are located.
The thing is, historically, even with this revolutionary technique, the data chains were often too short. If you only look at 10 nanometers of material, you just don't get statistically significant data to test a continuous long-range process like spinodal decomposition.
Right, and the sources emphasized this study overcame that.
Mm-hmm.
They used computer-controlled methods to extend the effective data chain length up to 40, maybe 60 nanometers. Why was that length so vital?
Because it allowed them to use the specialized data analysis required for this problem. The discrete fast Fourier transform, or DFT.
Discrete analysis, okay.
Fourier analysis is the perfect tool for wave phenomena. Since Kahn's theory models composition evolution as harmonic waves, Fourier analysis allows the researchers to decompose the raw compositional data into its constituent sine waves.
So if the atoms are separating spinodally, they should show up in the Fourier analysis as the precise compositional waves Kahn predicted.
Precisely. We use the DFT to generate specific kinetic plots. The most crucial ones are plots showing the amplitude factor versus the wave number beta 2. And even more importantly, beta 22 versus beta 2.
And that's the key plot.
Yes. The shape of that second plot, specifically its slope, directly proves whether the decomposition is driven by the negative interdiffusivity predicted by spinodal theory. It's the mathematical signature of the phase transition.
That transition from atomic measurements to abstract wave math is just, it's
yeah.
Incredible. Okay, let's see what this advanced toolkit revealed when they applied it to the three core model systems in the sources. We'll start with the simplest case, the binary alloy, nickel aluminium, Mi14.1% Li. This is where the theory was put to the ultimate test.
And this simple model alloy was a resounding success for Kahn's theory. The results conclusively demonstrated that the decomposition is indeed continuous. The quantitative evidence along the specific probing directions was textbook. The R versus OS plot showed a positive maximum, which indicated a dominant compositional wavelength of about 35 nanometers before it dropped off.
Exactly as predicted.
Exactly. But the real smoking gun came from that linear plot.
Tell us about that definitive proof. What was the number they found for D?
The beta 22 versus beta 2 plot showed the predicted linear relationship. And from the slope and the intercept of that line, they were able to calculate the interdiffusivity, D. The value they found was minuscule, around minus 4 times 10 to the minus 19 meters squared per second.
Wait, that number is tiny $4 times 1019, but the negative sign is the entire story here.
It is the entire story. That negative value for D is the characteristic fingerprint of uphill diffusion. It validated Kahn's kinetic theory of spinodal decomposition using real experimental data for the first time in this system. And as a final check, TEM images of the alloy showed that characteristic striated contrast we discussed, confirming the structure matched the kinetics.
That's a huge confirmation of a theory that's been debated for decades. Okay, now, let's pivot to a case with higher commercial relevance, the mnemonic PE16 matrix model. This alloy is much more complex, and its behavior was different.
Very different, yes. When they studied the precipitation in this model, they saw that the Y phase formed incredibly fast. It was fully accomplished within 20 minutes or less.
20 minutes, that's fast.
But the mechanism wasn't spinodal. When they tracked how the particles grew over time, their coarsening kinetics, it followed the standard T13 law.
And what does that T13 law signify in material science terms?
That exponent is the classic hallmark of volume diffusion controlled ripening, or VDC. This is the process where the large particles grow at the expense of the small ones. And the rate of growth is controlled by atoms diffusing conventionally downhill through the bulk matrix. This confirms that the PE16 model follows conventional nucleation and growth kinetics, not spinodal.
That provides critical insight into how commercial alloys stabilize. But the QAP compositional analysis revealed something even more important for engineers. The sources highlighted extreme compositional partitioning.
Absolutely. The QAP analysis showed how the elements ruthlessly partition themselves. The structural elements, nickel, aluminium, and titanium, all rush preferentially to the Y precipitate phase. That's what makes it strong.
Right.
But this leaves the remaining gamma matrix phase seriously stripped of those elements. And conversely, the other elements, iron, chromium, molybdenum, tend to accumulate or accumulate aggressively in the Y matrix. They are essentially pushed out of the growing Y phase.
So why does that segregation matter so much? I mean, the overall composition of the jet turbine component is known. Why do we need to know the composition of just the matrix?
Because of the danger of forming undesirable brittle phases. The overall bulk composition might look perfectly safe on paper, but if you look at the composition of the remaining matrix after the elements have partitioned, it can be dramatically different.
I see.
The research used FACOMP analysis to estimate the matrix's proximity to forming a severely brittle phase known as the sigma phase. And they found that because the iron and chromium pile up in the matrix, the actual gamma matrix is pushed perilously close to this phase field, much closer than the overall alloy composition would ever suggest.
That is a crucial nugget of knowledge. It means that while the bulk material appears stable, the matrix itself is teetering on the edge of a phase transition that would lead to catastrophic brittle failure. So knowing the mechanism and the segregation patterns lets engineers design alloys that pull that matrix composition back to safety.
Exactly. It shows that understanding phase separation is essential for predicting long-term reliability, not just initial strength.
Let's move to the most complex case study, ternary alloys like nickel, aluminium, titanium. Adding titanium really ratcheted up the complexity. What did this study reveal here?
The results were, well, they were much harder to classify. First, they found evidence that the Y precipitation was vacancy catalyzed. They observed that if they quenched the sample from lower temperatures, which meant fewer vacancies were available, they ended up with fewer but larger Y particles. The lower concentration of vacancies just limited the initial nucleation sites.
That's okay, that makes sense.
But more dramatically, the phase separation and the ordering process where the atoms arrange themselves into that rigid L1 Eurostructure happened extremely rapidly.
So fast that they couldn't distinguish which happened first.
Precisely. The researchers concluded that no clear transformation sequence could be assigned. This led to the conclusion that the two reactions, separation and ordering, might be fundamentally coupled in these highly supersaturated alloys.
And this is what they call spinodal ordering.
Spinodal ordering, yes. It suggests that the drive to separate compositionally and the drive to become structurally ordered occur simultaneously. They're indistinguishable kinetically.
Fascinating. We've covered everything from the abstract concept of uphill diffusion to the very practical implications of brittle phase formation.
And that's the core of this deep dive. We've established that by coupling advanced atomic scale tools like APFIM with sophisticated wave analysis via DFT, material scientists can move beyond just observing microstructure. They can quantify the fundamental kinetics governing the stability and strength of these critical materials.
And the key takeaways are really twofold. In simple systems like binary Ni-L, the classical counterintuitive theory of continuous spinodal decomposition is definitively confirmed. They found that necessary negative interdiffusivity.
Meanwhile, in the complex matrix models, the ones relevant to commercial applications like mnemonic PE16, the process is one of rapid nucleation and growth, followed by conventional VDC ripening, which then results in that dangerous compositional partitioning that has to be managed to avoid brittle failure.
And here is a final provocative thought for you to contemplate. If in these highly complex alloys like Nialte, phase separation and ordering happen so quickly that they are coupled, resulting in this ultra-fast binodal ordering, the next frontier of engineering isn't just finding the mechanism, but controlling it. Can we deliberately engineer the alloy system to show a highly depressed miscibility gap? If we could, we would gain ultimate kinetic control over these ultra-fast, coupled phase transitions, giving us the perfect, most stable YY microstructure every single time. Something to mull over as you contemplate the atoms in your next high-performance component.